So I think we can make a start probably now. Welcome everyone. I'm Sujit Sivasundaram, and this is the last seminar of our series for this term. And we'll be following the usual format of having 20-minute interventions from our two speakers and guests, and then we'll be opening to Q&A. And our session today is titled Literary Lineages. And I've actually been thinking that it's a really strange moment to be opening up this digital space on Zoom once again, given that firstly, there's this vast time difference between us, but also there's a cyclone hitting Sri Lanka at this minute as well. So just the juxtaposition of this digital space against the pandemic and the cyclone seems especially bizarre at this point in time. Anyway, more positively, it's a great pleasure to welcome two speakers who have been in the midst of a long-term conversation. So actually that conversation today forms part of a longer conversation that they themselves have been undertaking. Niloufer Demel is Professor of English at the University of Colombo. She did her PhD at the University of Kent. Her work has been concerned with gender, militarism, memory, and nationalism in Sri Lanka and beyond. She's an active participant in the cultural and activist life of Colombo, and she's one of Sri Lanka's leading scholars in the humanities. Her books include Women and the Nation's Narrative and Militarizing Sri Lanka. Her work brings together a really rich set of cultural sources, an unusual assembly of figures, writers, intellectuals, to suicide bombers, to argue for the mutability and adaptability of forms such as militarism and nationalism. Geeta Patel did her doctoral work in South Asian studies at Columbia and is now professor of Middle Eastern and South Asian languages and cultures and women, gender, and sexuality at the University of Virginia. And her work covers also a very wide range of very interesting themes. And I was just mentioning earlier that I noticed that she's also working on the history of bacteriology and our relationship to bacterial life, which seems especially appropriate. And this is in keeping with, I think, her training initially in the sciences. And she's also been writing on the lockdown in lyric form, I understand. But of relevance to our conversation today is her work on what she calls the collective conundrums posed by bringing gender, nation, sexuality, finance, science, media, capital, and aesthetics together, end quote. And this set of interests is evident, for instance, in her books, Lyrical Movements, Historical Hauntings, and Risky Bodies and Techno-Intimacy. So Niloufer is gonna go first for 20 minutes, and then we're gonna move to Geeta after that. Niloufer, over to you.
Thank you very much, Sujit, and thanks to the Center of South Asian Studies at Cambridge for inviting me to take part in this seminar. It is an honor for me to do so. And thank you to all of you who have joined in today, including Geeta, for joining me literally from the other side of the world. Okay. Located as I am at a Department of English, in a post-colonial, post-war Sri Lanka, translation is all around me. That is, translation as interlingual, as borrowings, crossings, and movement, as careful reading and re-narration, which is its promise, as well as translation that searches for synonymity and lexical obedience, which are its harder borders. I'm not a translator in the conventional sense. I do not shuttle easily between languages. I know Sinhala, but work mainly in Sri Lankan English. All languages, however, as Spivak pointed out in Death of a Discipline, carry the irreducibility of hybridity. And Sri Lankan English is a rich enough repository, not only of Britain's colonial footprint, but also of the Portuguese and the Dutch via its lexical and idiomatic borrowings from Sinhala, Tamil, Arabic, and Malay. These are also lineages of its ocean location. Literature, my primary subject, is again already polysemic in its multiple imaginaries, perspectives, and geographies, and interdiscursive in its purchase in the socio-political, cultural, and the juridical. A core skill learned through literary study of close readings attentive to rhetoricity, linguistic signature, and aesthetic technique enable us, particularly after cultural studies, to move in between and amongst diverse texts, as a translator does. Such travel, albeit not without checkpoints, has meant, in my case, working in the areas of literature, security, gender, urban, and performance studies. And it is from these alchemies and juxtapositions that I speak today on the narrativization of cities in an archive of Sri Lankan literature in English. Questions and threads from translation studies will emerge as I speak, including on my own practice as a critical reader and re-narrator. Time does not permit me to be exhaustive, so a couple of signposts will have to suffice. Commentaries on translation often characterize the translator as an intimate reader, and I will focus on what this means in relation to my current project on cities. Of how a city is given a habitation and a name, in Eva Keblovska-Lornichak's words, how it is narrativized as a space, locus of identity, topography, and metaphor, and how it is relationally brought into being in the archive. Where in literary critical practice, and this is certainly so in the case of Sri Lanka, or the Sri Lankan case, cities are mere reference points in contextualizing the main plot of a story or a character, I ask, what does it mean to center the city to make meaning of character stories and rhetoricity? To map the symbolic, topographical, and material manifestations of the city is a way of framing them, as Diana Taylor writes in Archive and the Repertoire, of how they continue to act politically. As part of this project, I examine Colombo's development as a world-class city, its aesthetic blueprint, and the classification of its residents as a biopolitical fiscal category. I now turn to the city of Jaffna, which in the Sri Lankan ethnopolitical imagination is Colombo's other. Jaffna, the major city of the north, dominates the narrative as the historical, political, and cultural hub of Sri Lankan Tamils, a hegemon not uncontested, particularly from other centers of Tamil habitation and influence, such as Batiklo in the east. But Jaffna remains in the larger public mind synonymous with Tamil political power and culture. So I was curious as to how this city is brought into being in Sri Lankan literature and English, and how its narration and re-narration contribute to why, as Tariq Jazil writes in his special reading of Michael Onjachi's Anil's Ghost, Sri Lanka's racialized politics of difference is inseparable from its spatial politics. And why it becomes, as Stuart Mota writes of the law as archive, a storehouse of violence that constitutes and sustains the state. Much like the translator who works with the source text that is itself a translation, in this work I have had to turn to multiple sources, albeit selective, for Jaffna inhabits a rich archive of colonial maps, travelogues, artifacts, land deeds, court records, landscape paintings, and portraiture. Different genre, these texts engage in linguistic and pictorial acts of recording, attributing to Jaffna an exotic lushness. I'm thinking here of the account by Jay Hafner, published in 1821, whose first stop, having escaped as a prisoner of war from Madras, was Jaffna Patna, or a tidiness, as when Bella Sidney Woolf drives through the city street in wonderment at, I quote, the neatly palisaded Tamil dwellings along the white dusty roads, marveling at the strangeness and remoteness of this world from the riotous luxuriance and picturesque untidiness of the Low Country. Together with the early paintings of sparse landscapes with their signature palmyra trees, and the portraits of Jaffna Tamils in dress and composure signifying social status, caste, and gender, these texts solidify to the European Jaffna as a geography of difference, a logic of conquest, and a source of marvelous wonder at the alien, which then gets comparatively mapped onto its people as habits of character. By the 19th century, that the Jaffnais are reiteratively cited as industrious, intelligent, thrifty, law-abiding, caste-ridden. These traits thereafter transfer to the early Sri Lankan English literary archive as caricature. I'm thinking of the 1934 play, He Comes from Jaffna, by E.F.C. Lodowick, a renowned Cambridge-educated figure in English studies and theatre at the University of Ceylon. Itself an adaptation of two prior plays, and these are reiterations which, like multiple translations, add value to the bona fides of a story and its form. It is through this play that Jaffna, as an object of citation, first comes into being in a significant way in Sri Lankan English literature. The play was very popular. It was performed 26 times by 1936, which is really impressive for a small English-speaking amateur theater and its audience. And it is still performed today, making it, together with H.C. Andilanarol's Velmudlia, one of the longest running plays in the Sri Lankan English theater repertory. In Lodowick's play, Jaffna as a topoi enters the dialogue only at the very end, literally in one sentence, when the protagonist, Durai Swami Pillai, the he who comes from Jaffna, persuades his brother-in-law to return to the peninsula asking, quote, "Don't you ever long for the open, empty white roads, the Palmyra fences, the blue lagoons and islands?" So for most of the play, Jaffna is figuratively epitomized in Durai, a middle-aged, thrifty, and extractive man who wryly refers to it as the home of all kinds of crooks and quacks. Stage entrances are always moments of rhetorical power in the theater. And Durai's entrance brokers to a target audience of English-speaking Colombo elites a putative ethnic specificity. He wears a white turban, white long coat, and white trousers, an attire which aligns him perfectly with the sartorial archive of the colonial portraits, photographs, and travel writing, including again by Bella Sidney Wolfe, of upper class and upper caste Tamil professionals dressed the same. Durai becomes thereby a synonymous referent of a stable archive, reinforcing a lineage as fact. But accompanying this facticity is an abstraction necessary for comic laughter in the play. Durai's highly agitated but triumphant entrance, having just won a battle with the rickshaw driver over a pittance saved, is a comic amplification, redoubled by what he carries. A bundle of drumsticks or murunga, a chembu, gingerly oil, and a tiffin carrier. The excess provokes laughter, a false note that is disruptive, denoting not just harmless eccentricity, but also a darker casteism via the food pollution trope the drumsticks and cooking vessels signify. This is a trope that has endured in the literary archive. For 57 years later, Jean Arasanagam would write in her poem, Women, Goddesses and Their Mythologies, of her Jaffna Tamil Vellala mother-in-law, who, I quote, came on her visit, traditional and matriarchal, to see the children sired by her son, packed her own food, cooked by her hands, pungent with curds and spice, so that she should not partake of those hospitable yet alien foods from vessels tainted with forbidden meats. Carving out an exceptionality for themselves, these upper caste figures from Jaffna suture a specific connection in the archive between race, caste, and place. So effective was this artifice that when the Sinhalese actor Stanley Abesinghe overdid his accent as Tambupille in H.C. Andilanarol's 1945 play 50-50, a reviewer commented at the time, not on the politics of the casting, but on Abesinghe's performance as, I quote, "a trifle too Jaffna." All concept cities, whether they are garden city, world-class, provincial, or modern, rely on an erasure of its actual heterogeneity for its branding. Lodowick's play does not refer to what else was going on in Jaffna at the time, apart from a reference to Christianization. Dalit resistance movements, such as the tea shop and temple entry movements, are off the record. The laughter of the characters, however, was utterly topical, a particular liberal response to fierce ethnic outbidding and the institutionalization of communal representation in the legislature that got solidified with the Donimo Constitution at this time. The satire also marked a liberal standpoint, with independence in its sights, that the litmus test of political maturity was the ability to laugh at oneself. But because the action takes place entirely in Colombo and the city appears as a personification, Jaffna, as an aggregate of its materiality, that is its buildings, roads, and rubble, and the immaterial, its perceptions and experiences, which, as Danny Hoffman writes, speaks to the relationship between the forms of the city and the lives of its inhabitants, remains flatlined in the play and disconnected. This was essential for the play's resolution. We survey, map, and identify cities relationally. And for the most part, Jaffna and Colombo are squared off against each other in the play, in the commonplace dualism of urban versus the rural. But Ludovic inverts this schema and its anticipated stereotypes of the mercantilist city and the hospitable rural by making Duret the embodiment of capital accumulation and Rajaratnam the naive redistributive socialist. As the plot thickens, however, both men not only influence each other, but become one another. And this actually keeps to both the original version of the play, the 1862 comedy by Eugene Labiche, and its 1892 adaptation by Sidney Grundy, named A Pair of Spectacles, in which character traits are symbolized in the dark-rimmed or rose-tinted spectacles they wear. So in Ludovic's play, as the story goes along, both men, as I said, not only influence, but become one another. And with Rajaratnam growing increasingly hard-nosed and Duret sentimental. Characteristics tied to place become interchangeable. In the face of such coevality, which is not compatibility on the basis of difference, but a universalizing, neutralizing move that when it acts politically can dehybridize and homogenize, what is the role of the intimate reader? This is a question that has troubled theorists of translation. In an essay on imaginative resistance, Severin Hubscher-Davidson locates imaginative resistance in the translator's disengagement with the source text on ethical grounds. Rapport, surrender, wonderment, seeing, and I quote Spivak here, the trace of oneself in the other, are all terms that have been used to describe the relationship of the translator to the source text. But Hubscher-Davidson asks us to think about this rather romanticized affinity, not as a linearity, but a continuum, so that imaginative resistance too is neither unwavering nor predetermined. But what is the implication of this disenchantment for the translator when it occurs? To the idea that we should not pore over what is untranslatable for a purchase in activating it as a heuristic of translation's creative failures, and I'm thinking of Emily Apter's work here, my own impulse has been to add context and ask, following Ananya Roy, for whom is the city a stable concept? For whom is it dangerous or safe? And why and what is asynchronous in the city? But is the ekphrasis or the detail that such inquiry demands any less implicated in violence? I try to answer this with a short reference to a 2018 war novel, Every Journey Ends by Aya Dure Santhan. I'm not really setting up Santhan here in opposition to Ludovic. My interest rather is on the work of narrative forms, their temporalities and their kinships. Said during the war, much of the action in Santhan's novel takes place in Jaffna, because even when the protagonist Murkan is away, he keeps returning to the city through recall. He is not a foil to a main character who lives elsewhere. Microgeographic descriptions of Jaffna Town, its roads, junctions, restaurants, transport terminals, and military checkpoints are described in the novel as places of activity and observation, safety and danger. This precise cartography enables a truth effect of Jaffna as a tangible and authentic place. If it is easier to detect the role of abstraction in legacies of violence, because we can see through its artifice of reduction, where do we place the work of ekphrasis, cartography and scaling that pulls us in through the pleasures of the particular that Toral Jatin Gajarawala writes of in his analysis of Naipaul's novel, Gorillas? It is not that parody and hyperbole, which build their argument on the oscillation of excess and reduction, do not carry the potential to reposition us in relation to our own politics of complicity in the inequities on display. They surely do. But it is hard to enjoy Ludovic's play now in a hindsight gained through a prolonged ethnic war. And reviews of the play from the 1980s onwards signal this disenchantment, marking its shelf life as over. Even though, as Ernest McIntyre's re-narration titled He Still Comes from Jaffna shows, the comedy and the conceit remain trenchant and useful to the story's retelling of the man from Jaffna, this time a terrorist. But to get back to Santhan, if the minutiae in his novel provides us salvific details of Jaffna, we need to remind ourselves that thick description had a performativity in Orientalist literature and had a purchase in colonial governmentality. Its significance thereafter in the realist novel, as Gajarawala notes, was in the way the descriptions become common sense as they immersed, enveloped, and situated objects, peoples, places. The ekphrasis and sedimentation entailed narrative debts for the colonized, debts from which the native can emerge, argues Gajarawala, only in a post-colonial text that adopts a non-realist, non-narrative, and non-descriptive form. This is a cautionary note on being alert to our own responses as readers, translators, and re-narrators. Ekphrasis works on many registers. So, placing Gajarawala alongside Santhan, we see that Santhan's characters do not suffer narrative death in the ways Naipaulian characters do. Their lives are risky in the war zone, so yes, they do come close to becoming crouching subjects, but they are resilient in how they navigate their surroundings using the options that specific roads, buildings, and junctions open up and close off. This makes Jaffna's spatiality not a neutral site on which the action unfolds, but its very substance. Santhan's cartography sits thereby alongside a lineage that not only includes colonial narratives, but also aerial satellite views of Jaffna Town and log entries of nighttime military patrols. The agentive co-constitution of the city and its residents may be how the literary lineage on Jaffna finally shifts, if not ruptures, and thereby pulls the intimate reader back to the subject at hand. But this translator reader would also have to labor with the work of ekphrasis as exactitude in a context where, on another register, these same details, whether in voters' lists or municipal maps, became the ground of atrocious violence in both Jaffna and Colombo. And I will end there. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Niloufar. That was great. And I will have time to ask questions once we've heard also from Geeta. So over to Geeta. Oh, Geeta, I think you're muted.
I'd like to thank the Center for South Asian Studies for honoring me with this invitation to join Niloufar in a conversation across different genres and regions that we've had for many years. I'd really like to thank Sujit for arranging all this, Michael and Kevin for managing us, and Niloufer Demel for being my very long, consistent interlocutor of choice. I'd like to honor the Monacan peoples from whose land I speak. Wandering from town to house, a wayfarer misplaces the road that gathers him home, which was once mine, and your belongings, both forsworn from memory, mine and yours no longer known. Nagri nagri pira musafir, ghar ka rasta bhul gaya, kya hai mera, kya hai tera, apna paraya bhul gaya. As I turn to look at everyone passing by, I find they all nurse one simple reproach. Why, when I can recall everything so fully, has my time forgotten me? Jisko dekho, uske dil mein shikwa hai to itna hai. Jisko dekho, uske dil mein shikwa hai to itna hai. Hame to sab kuch yaad raha, hame to sab kuch yaad raha. Humko zamana bhool gaya. Has my time forgotten me, mine and yours no longer known? Translation theory from the Global South. What happens to literary lineages when they've been forgone under pressure from colonial administrators bent on projects of governmentality directed at and organized through literature and in particular poetry? What Emily Apter terms sundered filiation. A whole slew of these projects underwritten by translation from English into local languages, with Urdu as merely one of its many sites, was orchestrated in the mid-19th century, post the War of Independence in 1857, where so many were killed. Some of the projects funded the composition of refurbished lyrical forms in the guise of prize money given to the most literally descriptive poetry at symposia at Lahore in the 1870s. These were organized under the auspices of colonial administrators such as Colonel Holroyd, responsible for education policy in Punjab. The intent, the maqsad in Urdu, was oriented towards transmuting the conditions of the composition of lyric, how verse was written and what was written, turning the pleasures coded into the euphoric, anguish, teasing, multivocal chanciness of metaphor to dry a verse, bursting with detail, which tuned into ekphrasis for its semiotic registers. Altaf Hussain Hali, the 19th century lyricist, translator, theorist of literary matters, and philosophical historian of the intellectual lineages encoded into Islam, named this new genre of verse natural shayari. 1857 made it clear to colonial administrators that they had to modulate colonial resistance that was liable to break out into full-fledged violence. Paradoxically, as the side notes administrators appended to pension documents revealed, they believed that this could only be achieved not just through sovereignty established by a force majeure, conceived of as a compulsion to obey inscribed through law and legal mandates. Rather, as was the case with pensions, which tied everyone who received a pension into a kind of faith in those who were responsible for giving it, they judged that they had to come up with more subtle covert strategies to bind colonial denizens to the state. One possible route was through the persuasions of the heart collateralized by capital, which was so deeply felt that they could not be released. Something more akin to Antonio Gramsci's invocation of hegemony, control through ideology folded into everyday common sense or inculcated habit a la Marcel Mauss. The law enabled and enforced through the facticity of sovereign authority in a way closer to that proposed by Carl Schmitt couldn't achieve the same ends. In the ideological lay the grounds of what Ludwig Wittgenstein goes on to speak of in uncertainty as belief. Belief is a bit more than common sense. What was to be valued, how one valorized one's moral worth or culpability. All these came together at this cusp where governance and the aesthetic met. Translation could be said to be its carrier. Colonial subjects, such as Altaf Hussain Hali, translated from English in response to, and perhaps to re-script stereotypical caricatures of morally retrograde colonial subjects, those that had been widely circulated by pamphleteers such as Charles Grant in the 18th century. Of course, as Gauri Vishwanathan has masterfully explored in her now classic monograph, and scholars writing in English, such as Uday Mehta, as well as those writing in Indian languages, have shown us over and over, education in English, given Philip through Lord Macaulay's Minute on Education, and brought to actual fruition many, many years after, established some of the colonial tenets of utilitarian liberalism in the colonies. And projects of translation from South Asian languages into English have a long history of traffic that shipped translated texts to Britain and Europe as mercantilist artifacts with profound political, philosophical, and literary ramifications, as Manan Ehmed has recently illustrated. Here today, I want to turn to something else, not the effects of education in English, not the translation of South Asian materials into English, but those of tutelage through English transported into South Asian languages. To see how one can theorize translation here, I ferry in the word tarjuma from Urdu via Arabic and via pre-Semitic languages and fold it into the Sanskrit root tr, tarati, transport, transmute, swim over, from which the word avatar is born. And I, just a side note, I've left out anuvad, which is the word of choice. I prefer the tarati in relation to what it does. Tarjuma, as well as Hassan, the translator from Arabic of Abdel Fattah Kilito's magisterial readings of passages, Arabic texts, went through time in Thou Shalt Not Speak My Language. As Hassan explains, tarjuma brings biography or life, explanation and interpretation together. Tarjuma's possible line of descent through the Arabic root rajuma also conveys damned, reviled, soothsaying, uncertain and unreliable speech. And the effect of translation, tarjuma, tarati, understood in this way, was not just to make anglicized ideas amenable to a larger Urdu-speaking audience, but to make one's tongue over. It made Urdu so utterly something else that the words one used changed. And rather than what one was compelled to write, how and what one wished to write, henceforth was amended. Language itself changed. And the word that the ironically, and I think importantly, that the British use for this is changed into the vernacular. Urdu was expected to assume another life, another avatar, become amenable through translation. That all languages mutate, absorb, collude, hybridize is a truism. In how they do it lie the politics that underscore what's at stake for Altaf Hussain Hali, that meant turning away from his own teachers and literary forebearers, edging away from Farsi, the language of Mughal governance, finance, jurisprudence, to his English, not as his tongue, but as one necessary forefather. Hali's anguish at this loss, the loss of his own lineages, is profound. The excitement of new possibilities that tarjuma might open for Hali, modulated by their unreliability, as Homi Bhabha has suggested a long time ago in his discussion of colonial makeovers, mimesis, in imitating a colonizer, is also an incompleteness, here carried in by Hali's grief, or perhaps his ongoing melancholia. When scholars speak of target languages, they rarely bring to the surface this failure, the politics that transmute the language into which translation takes place as one rendered friable fraying in the crucible of colonial governance. Perhaps this is what Gayatri Spivak ought to have intended, though she didn't articulate it quite in the way I mean today when she says in her essay, The Politics of Translation, that, and I quote, the writer is written by her language, of course, but the writing of the writer writes agency in a way that might be different. Safety is the appropriate term here, because we're talking of risks of violence to the translating medium. Translating, and I return to myself, translating is dangerous business. Tarjuma turns one's language into the language of the damned. Wandering from town to house, a wayfarer misplaces the road that gathers him home. The Urdu poet Miraji, the verses of whose ghazal I opened with, the ghazal is bhul gaya, it is forgotten, could be considered one of the founders of modernism in Urdu. Miraji Sanauladar lived from 1912 to 1949 and was arguably one of the most inventive, theoretically nuanced prose masters and lyricists in colonial South Asia. His prodigious outpourings included essays and translations on poetry and on other poets. What marked him out were his closely passed, dense readings of his own compatriots, his open-ended renderings of verse from poets who lived in other times and places and came to his notice in the 1930s via books shipped in to libraries he haunted tirelessly, as his Archives of Belonging, to misquote Susan Sontag. Literature then provided the venue through which Miraji became a wayfarer, a traveler. He began culling, picking, and choosing what he went on to translate from the books piled in public libraries in Lahore as he sat ensconced behind the massive neoclassical Georgian facade of the now Qaid-e-Azam Library, or hunched over a desk under the soaring vaulted ceilings of the glorious neo-Islamic government, now Punjab Public Library. Hali earned his living correcting translations in the 19th century at the crowded Punjab Book Depot in Lahore. One can envision him surrounded by stacks of teetering files. By the 1830s, Lahore was a different city than Hali's. It now brimmed with other sorts of literary and political possibilities that emerged from the jostling of different communities along Lahore's byways. On the streets of Lahore and in homes, poets met and formed conclaves such as the Halka Erbab-e-Zork, the circle of the men of taste to ponder over and exchange poetry and lyric. Journals such as Adb-e-Latif were circulating the writing of the day. Miraji himself is often given life through accounts of him settled into and as though growing out of the cities in which he lived. Cities, as Nilufar Demel has shown us, people their architecture through juxtapositions of map to description, with somewhat unexpected effects or ramifications. Anise Nagi, who writes a biographical essay on him, draws Miraji out in the context of a family home in Lahore, where Miraji had turned one tiny room into a Sahar Khana, a poet's garret. The house was tucked into the winding lanes of Mazang, its facade tightly closed, but Nagi renders that description through details, ekphrasis, that could easily have been excavated from maps delineated in the Imperial Gazetteer's Architecture of Governmentality or via E.M. Forster's Chandrapur, emphasizing, as Nagi does, the narrow and tortuous lanes, mean and gloomy appearance of the area. Colonial cartographies calibrate morality, and the translation of those older streets into a refurbished colonial lexicon of decrepitude carries over into Nagi's portrayal of Miraji as lacking in moral fortitude, what we can see from our vantage point now as a somewhat Dionysian madman. But perhaps this is unwittingly apt in its way, for in the translations to which Miraji turned his hand extensively in Lahore, he searched assiduously for those lyricists who refused or were refused propriety. It was as though Lahore itself, having been the space where translation had foreclosed its own opening gestures, now threw up the possibilities for kinship that translation might have wrought, whether they were tucked into the verses by geishas or French symbolists or Sappho. In both Hali's and Miraji's case, translations were the places through which literary family trees were refashioned, but oriented very differently. Both were genres of disruptive kinship. François Nudelman's, and I quote, elective as opposed to genetically ordained affinities, families without parents, according to Apta. But Miraji's untranslatable stood outside language families, finding their path through broken ties, soulmates, and monsters, as Apta describes them, while Hali's kept reaching for a hope of a family. Miraji, that which was once mine and your belongings, Gayatri Spivak, but no amount of tough talk can get around the fact that translation is the most intimate act of reading. As with Nilufer, a portion of my own training is vested in literary methodologies, in the intimacies that very close reading, diving into texts completely and losing oneself in them, enable. So too with Miraji. Miraji made an art of reading closely. However, he was an unfailingly unreliable translator. And this is where he ventured his philosophical insights on translation and what translation could promise or forestall. In her monograph on world literature, Emily Apter suggests that only if we don't make a virtue of poising what is amenable to what is amenable to be translated against what is untranslatable, demanding that we oppose one another in a Manichaean fashion, can we see something of import emerge. Miraji would appear to concur with Apter in some ways. In his translations and in the deftly drawn out essays he composed on the poets he translated. Miraji translated widely, carefully choosing poets towed in from different parts of the world to enable a process of worlding. They offered him a conclave from which he could extract an ulterior kinship, Banke Theri, from a gallery of misbegotten roads. None of them could have found their way into the English prose or poetry Hali would have been called to translate into Urdu. Those Miraji settled upon could be considered lyricists who were likely to draw imaginative resistance in his readers in the sense that Nilufer Demel proposes. But it was not that as a translator himself, he himself disengaged from a source text on ethical grounds, as Nilufer says. Rather, he called upon his readers as translators to face their own imaginative resistance to what they read, to tussle with their refusals to accept with what they encountered, so that they could eventually release that resistance and fall into the text, become intimate with it in a process that Miraji called hamdardi, sharing pain. In so doing, they would breach what had once seemed untranslatable to them because it was morally suspect. His essay on Sappho was one such exemplary instance. As Miraji intimates, Sappho found her voice over time through translation. But as a figuration, she also faced the imaginative resistance of translators who excised her from their annals. As a woman lyricist who sang the delight and torment of love for other women, she violated the religious sentiments of those who had envisioned themselves as holding a higher moral and religious ground. Sappho, as queer songster who could incite imaginative resistance, provided an object lesson for Miraji's compatriots. By the time Miraji had begun his own sojourn as a doyen of Urdu modernism, ekphrasis, with Hali premised through it, had become the method of the day. Ekphrasis, in the guise of literary realism, hakikat parasti aynadari, was political aesthetic. Ekphrasis, art mirroring life through its welter of detail, was deemed the most salvific and viable route to a robust indictment of violence to everyday life, the kind of violence that colonialism had wrought. Only if one could describe fully could one respond appositely. Miraji took this on through his translations. Though Miraji himself wrote enigmatic, what he calls mubham, philosophically playful, obscure verse as a riposte to his contemporary's devotion of paraspi to realism, he did not entirely shun detail. His essays on poets such as Sappho, a chock-a-block with historical materials on Sappho and on the Greek lyric of her time. It has minutely and tenderly crafted descriptions of Sappho's lifeways, her desires, her exiles, her political engagements. But Miraji turned ekphrasis on its head. Details that record and authenticate make us imagine that we hold facts in our hands with ease, allow us to succumb to what Alyssa LeBeau, the documentary maker and theorist of documentary, terms epistophilia, an excessive overweening preoccupation with knowing that haunts the practice of documentary. In his essay on Sappho, Miraji resorts to several strategies to undercut epistophilia. To get to tarjuma, you have to marshal interdisciplinary resources and registers the political, the historical, the scientific, the economic, the aesthetic. Translation is interdisciplinary, and so also are the roots to arrive at it and to garner its import. Everything Miroji describes lovingly is laid out through the conditions of its production in these through these forms, through these disciplines. And the putative authors he draws on and their failings accounted for multifariously and meticulously. And all the details are spoken, however, in the grammar of surmise, fleshed out as merely a possible past, what may have been, but equally could not have been. Miroji thus theorizes the archive for us. For him, it's art, as all art is liable to be, is a translation, a transit of life. Adab zindagi ka tarjuman hai. And translations are options we settle upon, but could just as easily release. As with all others on lyric in translation, this essay too enunciates the politics of language, gives us an entree into a philosophy of translation birthed under colonial constraints. In several places, Miroji writes about his cohort having lost their way after 1857, their tongue adrift, their path to a future murky. When filiations are sundered, Miroji suggests that poets rattle around with nowhere to go. The questions then for him lie here. You can scrounge your own chosen lineages from scraps and bits that are left behind. We have to, after all, with Sappho, who shows up in fragments. The issue is not that you do it, but how you do it and where it leads you. The method, the how in what you do, is the other object lesson that Sappho allows him to access. Miroji does this through a dramatic flourish. Taking the Greek form of the symposium and translating it into a loosely filled mushaira gathering of poets, the essay staged as its place of possibility is Sappho, is where Sappho trades love lyric, overflowing, bustling with metaphoric nuance and specificity, with two poets who share her lyrical sensibility as possible filiations. One is a poet from Miroji's own time, Akhtar Shirani, who has a fluid facility with ardor, and the other, Mirabai, the mistress of mystical love, whose verses through the centuries have been recomposed over and over under her name. Sappho is drawn into Miroji's Urdu, a tongue loosened through metaphor, and it is an Urdu that flits between Arabic, Farsi, Braj, Hindustani, a small smidgen of Sanskrit. The target language, Urdu, lives as something else in translation, in tarjuma, in tarithi. It sidles away from the lyrical lexical rhythms that Altaf Hussein Hali's translations from English had it bear. But even as I translate Miroji's Urdu back into English, the source language that gifted Miroji his archives, it's clear to me that so too does English. Miroji's verses barely match up to any English versions that one could hold onto as their precursors, and mine slide away even further. What is the target language and what is an origin are inescapably sullied. Both are in peril. Neither can quite find their way home. A lesson to which Walter Benjamin, writing about 10 years before Miroji, wended his way through translation, a lesson to which Benjamin was well attuned. Wandering from town to house, a wayfarer misplaces the road that gathers him home, which was once mine and your belongings, both forsworn. From memory, mine and yours no longer known. Nagri, nagri, pira musafir. Nagri, nagri, pira musafir. Ghar ka rasta bhul gaya, kya hai mera, kya hai tera. Apna paraya bhul gaya, apna paraya bhul gaya.